Washington University School of Medicine Oral History Program. Oral History number 56. October 18th, 1982. I am Paul Anderson. I am speaking today with Dr. Carl F. Corey. Dr. Corey was born in Prague in 1896. For a written account of his life, the researcher is advised to consult Dr. Corey's autobiographical article, The Call of Science, published in Annual Review of Biochemistry, Volume 38, 1969, pages 1 to 20, and other materials in the archives. The interview was recorded in Dr. Corey's laboratory of the Department of Biochemistry at the Harvard University School of Medicine in Boston, Massachusetts. Dr. Corey, you were born in Prague, of what I presume was a family of German heritage. Is that not the case?
Yes.
How long had your family lived in Bohemia?
Well, my father's family lived there a long time, and my mother's family as well.
Did they consider themselves Austrians or Germans or?
They considered themselves Austrian because at that time Bohemia was part of the Austro-Hungarian Empire.
Most of your years growing up were spent in Trieste, so.
Yes, when I was 2.5 years old, my father moved to Trieste because he became the director of the Marine Biological Station. And I grew up in Trieste and went to school there until I went to Prague to study medicine.
Were there many German gymnasiums in, German-speaking gymnasiums in Trieste?
There was one German-speaking and one Italian.
I see. But how large a city was it then?
No, it was about, I'm not quite sure, I would say 200,000, something of that order.
And most of the people were Italians?
And Yugoslavs.
Yeah, Slovenes.
In the gymnasium there were Germans, Italians, and Yugoslavs.
All being educated in
German.
Did the Austrians try to make it a German city? Did they, at that time, try to enforce
No, that was not part of their aim to do that. It was a very rich city at that time because it was the outlet of the large inland. There was a lot of shipping. Most of the migration to America from this area went through Trieste.
In 1914, you entered the Karl Ferdinand Universität of Prague to study medicine.
Yes, I am named after that university.
Why were you named after the university?
Because many of my ancestors were connected with this university. My father, of course, studied medicine there and zoology. He had an MD, PhD degree. And my grandfather was professor of theoretical physics at the university. My maternal grandfather.
Was it for family reasons that you went to Prague, or were there other reasons?
No, since my father started his career in Prague and then had his appointment in Trieste, it was natural that the family would be in Prague.
What about the city, Prague? Once again, we have a multinational city, about how, what was the percentage of German and what was the percentage of Czech at that time?
Well, I don't know, but I returned to Prague to study medicine, and then I had a better understanding of the city than when I left it at 2.5 years of age.
Yes.
And in person, it's a beautiful city, really, and interesting. I learned a little Czech, but not enough to communicate easily. And there was a fair German population, but the majority of the people were Czech.
And see, did the Czechs have their own university?
Yes. There were two branches to this university, one German and one Czech.
I see.
Complete universities for, I mean, all the faculties in both the German and the Czech universities.
Was the Czech university a new?
No, this is an old university. Prague has one of the old the universities in Europe.
It was in fact the oldest German university, I think, was it not?
Well, these things can be debated, they're not particularly interesting.
Uh-huh. You succeeded in completing 3 years of medical study before you were drafted into the army.
Yes.
What was there a policy of exempting medical students?
Well, I started to study medicine when I was 17. I was not of age to be drafted.
Mm-hmm. Later on, of course, they were drafting 17-year-olds.
Yes, but not at that time. And I, in fact, during basic training in the army, I still managed to hear a few courses in the medical school.
I see. As you know, many German and Austrian universities accepted American students before the war, and this historian's attribute was one of the reasons why American medicine developed the way it did.
Well, that was mostly in Vienna.
I see, but
a large influx of Americans was to Vienna, which at that time had prominent people on its medical faculty and gave courses for foreigners. And, clinical medicine and pathology particularly were very good.
There weren't many American students then at Prague.
Oh, there were, but not as many as in Vienna.
When they came, perhaps they took the entire medical curriculum except and not the short clinical.
Well, of course, since I started in 1914 to study medicine, nobody came at that time because of the political conditions, but I'm just speaking about what I know. At that time, there were no Americans.
It was in Prague that you met Gerty Corey, is that right?
Yes.
And she was a native of Prague, like yourself.
Yes.
She was a daughter of a businessman named Otto Radnitz.
Yes, he was the director of sugar factories. You know, there was a large sugar industry, beet sugar industry. And Bohemia, they exported a lot of refined sugar.
I see.
And he was the director of several such factories.
She attended a gymnasium in a town called Tetschen.
She did not attend a gymnasium. She took the examinations there and studied privately. When she decided to study medicine, she did not have the proper education to enter medical school. So in order to do so, she had to pass the examination of the gymnasium.
Uh-huh.
And she did that at Tetschen.
Where was Tetschen in regard to Prague?
Oh, it was in the north of Bohemia.
I see. Was it unusual, continuing this, for women to matriculate in medicine in Prague in
1940? There were other women in medical school, and not too many, so it was still unusual for women to study medicine.
How long had they been permitted to study medicine? Was there any particular time when women?
I cannot tell you when, but universities in general were always open to women. If they qualified, they could enter the university
and the qualification was an examination at the end of your gymnasium. It's a very comprehensive oral examination, and if you pass that, you could enter university.
You were drafted into the Army in 1917, is that right? It was, would have been 3 years?
No, I was drafted in 1940. You mean in the Army?
Yes, into the Army.
Well, it could have, it was certainly after 1914, perhaps 17 is right.
This was before you had finished your medical degree.
Yes.
Why was your study broken off then? Did they just need soldiers that so badly?
They employed me as a medic, and the first assignment, military assignment I had was to serve with the ski troops as a medic.
Where did they send you with the ski troops?
They sent me to mountains, that mountainous region that is to the north, on the northeast, frontier with Germany, and close to the frontier with Germany, which is now Silesia in Germany.
Riesengebirge?
Riesengebirge is right, yes. Uh-huh. And so I knew how to ski, of course, and so it was a rather nice assignment.
But there was an accident that caused an end to this, was there not? Didn't you have an accident that forced you to leave this?
No, I was in a we had some vacation, and I went down to the valley, skied down to the valley with some of the other boys, and they didn't like the activity, so I left them and walked back alone during the night. But I took a rather difficult route, and in doing this, I got into considerable difficulties. Then the Wege had fallen. I got into fog and lost my way, and only returned to the quarters around 4 a.m. By this time, they were a bit excited where I was.
So you were officially absent without leave.
Well, not that, but they were not worried where I was.
I see. You were assigned later on to a bacteriological laboratory.
Yes. Where after this assignment, I went to do work in the bacteriological laboratory.
And there, as I understand, you contracted typhoid fever.
Yes. Yes. I don't think it's dysentery. I suppose my technique was not that good. I wasn't personally sufficiently careful, you know. It looked like a laboratory infection, but it may not have been. There was a lot of typhoid fever around, and it turned out that the vaccination they gave us was really not effective.
I see. But you say that possibly that began led you to start thinking about biochemical problems, this immunology.
Well, of course, I learned the bacteriological techniques and isolating pathogenic organisms, identifying them, and little serology, and so. And of course, I took books along and studied medicine all the time. So.
Where was this laboratory?
In a city called Laibach, now called Ljubljana.
In Slovenia.
There was an infectious hospital there, and connected with that from the laboratory.
And for a while, you were also compiling statistics on infectious diseases, were you not? You were compiling statistics. There was some.
No, not as later. I was sent forward, and I was close to the Piave, where the front was. And I was in a hospital for infectious diseases that was staffed by Hungarians. There I could do some clinical work.
Before that, you worked.
After that, I had a job of gather statistics and writing a weekly report about the health condition.
I see. You were for a time at your father's laboratory in Trieste.
It happened that I was sent there, yes, but that was a relatively short time. I was sent to set up the laboratory in Trieste, and I did a little bacteriological work of samples to send in meat, particularly to the clear, whether it was possible or not, or whether it was infected. That sort of work I did, but lasted only a short time.
Uh-huh. And you had another run-in with the problem with a comrade, right, who reported you for...
That was in Trieste, yes.
Uh-huh. And then you were sent to the front lines?
Yes.
And as a result, you were saved because you were in an automobile accident. And was that a very serious injury? You talked about having an artery...
glass cut the temporal artery.
Where would you have been sent had you arrived to the East Front?
No, I was sent to Italy.
I see. At the end of the war, as I say, you've already told me you were on the Piave River and you worked with Hungarians. Did you speak any Hungarian?
Well, I learned a few words of Hungarian. I had to do that. But I want to say one thing that was interesting to me in connection with the hospital for infectious diseases. I was assigned a survey of the civilian population because I spoke Italian and learned it in Trieste. Uh-huh. And I was supposed to find out what infectious diseases there were among the civilian population. And I did that by starting out in the morning with a horse and buggy. And a black satchel. And when I came to some crossroads, the farmer flagged me down and took me to the house where there were sick people. And that was an interesting experience. These poor farmers had very little to eat, but when you came into the house, they offered you a glass of wine, and you refused. That would be very offensive. And then when you uncovered the patients, there were hundreds of fleas in their drums.
Do you think that's the way life was all the time?
Fleas transmit typhoid fever. So
yes.
I had no fleas, so this was very disagreeable to me.
Uh-huh.
But since I had by that time passed typhoid fever, I was probably immune.
Uh-huh.
But it was an interesting experience to contact with the civilian population.
Do you think that's the way they lived at all times, or was it just because of wartime austerity?
No. The Germans had been through there, and they had probably taken away anything that was above ground. They had the food underground.
Uh-huh.
And they were the food. They were tenant farmers. They were poor and under any conditions.
Uh-huh.
This is incidentally the reason where the earthquake occurred a few years ago, called the Friuli.
Yes.
Uh-huh. And I was in that neighborhood.
What did Gerti Radnitz do during the war?
Well, she served in the clinic and was engaged. After all, many of the soldiers came back to Prague wounded or with diseases that they acquired. And so she served in this capacity. She also served in the refugee clinic.
Mm-hmm.
Of people from the east who had to flee because of the war conditions.
I see. The war ended in 1918. And what was Prague like when you returned there? What was the defeat like for?
It did not seem to penetrate very deeply, you know. Prague was better off because they had enough to eat.
Uh-huh.
When I then went to Vienna, I really saw the after effects much more in the sense that there was very little to eat, and that the Huber relief was required for hospitals, for example, to feed the patients and so on. But when I returned to Prague, everybody was happy that the war was over and there was not such a feeling of defeat. And of course, the Czechs had established their own republic, independence,
mm-hmm.
and so they were very happy about it.
Well, wasn't there a terrific influenza epidemic across Europe at this time?
Yes, I lived through that. And that was one of the reasons, probably, I never wanted to practice medicine, because as a doctor you were completely helpless. These poor soldiers came in and were dead in 24, something, 48 hours, they died of pneumonia and they couldn't do anything. I thought that one knew so little, but one better went to the laboratory and find out what's going on. This certainly influenced me very strongly.
Was emphysema also a problem?
Well, that comes on later.
Yeah.
If they survive, they're very likely to get an emphysema.
Uh-huh. You allude in your article, that's the article, The Call of Science, to a summer in which you worked in Bratislava.
Yes.
At the Pharmacological Institute. This was after the war, though.
Yes. Uh-huh.
Would that have been 1919 then, the year immediately after the war that you...
That was about 1920.
I see. You said that there was a university had been founded there, but it was Hungarian, founded as Hungarian.
Well, the university was entirely new
uh-huh.
and had been built in peacetime with the idea that it would be a Hungarian university
uh-huh.
because Bratislava, this is the Czech name, Pressburg is the mm-hmm. German name, and Pozsony is the Hungarian name.
Uh-huh.
At that time it was part of Hungary.
It was primarily a Slovak population
yes.
though in the city, and
yes.
that's why it became capital of Slovakia, didn't it?
Yes.
Didn't it? You participated in the transport of this Pharmacological Institute
yes.
across the lines to the
across the Danube.
Across the Danube, I see. Where did it wind up in Hungary?
The professor who was the pharmacologist in the Hungarian University in Pressburg was transferred to Hungary
uh-huh.
and so we took the equipment and put it across the Danube so we could continue when we settled
Was this Dr. Mansfield?
Yes, mm-hmm. Mansfield. Yes.
Mansfield. In 1920, I understand you went to Vienna for postdoctoral work.
Yes.
And there you divided your time between internal medicine and pharmacology.
Yes.
What was your work in medicine at the Allgemeines Krankenhaus?
Yes.
What could you describe that institution as it was then?
Well, the clinic with wards and private rooms
uh-huh.
and
it was the largest hospital of Vienna. Though.
Yes, there were several university clinics, and the director of this clinic was a man called Eppinger.
Eppinger?
Yes.
And he was your preceptor?
He was my preceptor, and he was a man who did clinical medicine, but also laboratory work.
I see.
And so, if you entered his clinic, you were expected to do some research for some laboratory work.
Uh-huh.
And so it didn't work there.
Why did you do work in pharmacology at this time?
Well, for the reason I mentioned, that uh-huh. I was not sure whether I wanted to stay in clinical medicine.
Uh-huh.
And so I wanted to have that. And I had begun to do pharmacology in Pressburg this summer, but we talked about
You in pharmacology, you worked under Dr. Meyer.
He was then retired, but he was Hans Meyer was a famous pharmacologist because he had developed a theory of anesthesia. His basic idea was that the anesthetic agents are soluble in lipids, more soluble in lipids than in water, which indeed they are. And so since brain is full of lipids, the brain takes off more anesthetic. So he developed a theory, but he was retired at that time. And his successor was a man by the name of Pick.
How would that be spelled?
P-I-C-K. The initials were E-P-K.
But you describe yourself as one of the few who had the capability of doing research.
The pharmacology introduced is practically inactive, but the reason I could work is that my father, who had then returned to Prague, because Trieste was no longer available, Marienburg station was closed, so he returned to his alma mater to Prague, where he became the professor of zoology. And he was able to send me some frogs, because Bohemia has many ponds, and get frogs. I had 50 frogs, and I had to put them on the lock and key because people would have eaten them. This is the period, and there was no food available. And this enabled me to do some work. I was probably the only one who worked. All of the other things were. It was a very poor period in Germany.
What kind of experiments did you run with the frogs?
Well, I did some experiment on the frog heart. I was interested in continuing some work I had done in Bratislava, Pressburg, Poznan, namely the effect of the nerve stimulation.
It's curiously what your later colleague, Dr. Erlanger, was working on in the United States.
Erlanger was a physiologist who worked on, he was a neurophysiologist. He worked on nerves and the electrical activity.
Well, before then, he was still working on such matters as heart block.
Had worked on the human heart.
What was, outside of the fact that you had frogs, what was a laboratory in pharmacology like at that time? What did you?
Well, there was some simple instruments with which you could record the contraction of the heart. One uses the frog heart because it survives very well, whereas the mammalian heart requires more elaborate setups to beat, but although it can also be made to beat for hours when separated from the body, but you have to have special equipment. The frog heart is simple and yet reflects heart activity of higher animals. You can study drugs on the frog heart, but it's a different part of the activity of pharmacology institute at that time, working with frog heart.
Was it unusual for pharmacologists to be doing that kind of research?
No.
In August of 1920, you married Gerti Radnitz.
Yes.
And you mentioned in your article that thereafter she returned to Prague. This was in Vienna that you were married, right? And but you make no mention that you yourself went to Prague. Were you separated for a time after that for professional reasons?
Well, no. In Vienna, she worked at the children's hospital, and I had two jobs that you mentioned. But she got an eye disease, which is now recognized as a deficiency in vitamin E.
Mm-hmm.
And it was treated as a tuberculosis, but of course wasn't. And when nothing seemed to work, she went home. And as soon as she got on a better diet,
So it was just for recuperation that she went home to.
But after that, I went to Graz.
Uh-huh.
And that is when we were living for a while separately. It was a question of getting jobs, and also the job also provided me with food in some way.
Uh-huh.
So you couldn't just travel around because the conditions weren't favorable.
I want to break at this time to change the tape. When last we were speaking, we had got as far as your moving to Graz, and at the University of Graz you worked.
Well, I worked there with Professor Otto Luigi, who was well known for his work on the transmission of nerve impulses to the heart, which was accompanied by chemical events. This was probably the first indication that nerve impulses liberate chemicals,
mm-hmm.
and which imitate or may even be responsible for the nerve action. The particular nerve you work with slows the heart, or if strongly stimulated can even stop the heart.
Mm-hmm.
And the substance which is transmitted is acetylcholine, which when added directly to the heart also stops the heart. So that was the work for which he was awarded the Nobel Prize.
Did you assist him in any of this
by
research?
The time I got there, the basic work had been done, but I suggested to look at other things in the heart to see whether the same principle obtained.
Mm-hmm.
So, but I had already done previous work with this nerve in the heart, so I was familiar with the technique, but I stayed there a short time because from there I went to Buffalo, New York.
Uh-huh.
I left here.
You said it was a very, otherwise it was kind of disagreeable living in Graz.
Yes, it was even less food there than in Vienna, and the university was in a sort of turmoil, and really couldn't stay there because of his Jewish ancestry.
Uh-huh.
And that was a very disagreeable.
Where did he go after he left Graz?
He came to the United States eventually.
Uh-huh.
But he was by that time retired.
Uh-huh. I know many years later he came to Washington University to visit you, did he not? Or was it at Buffalo that he...
Well, I visited him at the same time, and then the other way around.
I see.
He often went to Woods Hole in summertime.
I see. By this time you had considerable experience as a pharmacologist, and yet 10 years later people were questioning whether you were a pharmacologist at all. Does this
I knew more pharmacology than my colleagues gave me credit for, and I also published some papers with pharmacological techniques, so they couldn't deny that I knew pharmacology, but they didn't like my going into biochemistry and bringing biochemistry into pharmacology.
So the Americans were more rigid on disciplinary lines than...
chemistry, of course, but only to modify drugs or synthesize drugs or things like that, but not to introduce biochemistry into the teaching of pharmacology. Of course, nowadays that is understood.
In 1922, you elected to come to the United States, I believe. And you went to be a biochemist at the State Institute for the Study of Malignant Disease in Buffalo.
Yeah.
Was this a move a kind of shot in the dark for you? Did you know where you were going pretty much from?
No, I didn't know exactly what the institution would be like, but the then director, a man called Gaylord, had been to Vienna, and he had asked Hans Rosmeyer, the retired head of pharmacology, whether he could recommend somebody. And since I was working there and had gotten some results, Meyer recommended me, and that's how I got to know Gaylord, who interviewed me briefly.
Did you speak English well by this time?
Not particularly.
No?
But enough to communicate.
It was a half year later that Gertie Corey came to Buffalo, and in doing so she had to leave a position at the Children's Hospital in Vienna, did she not?
Well, that was not a paid position, you know, nor was my position paid in any way. They were volunteers, they had no money to pay us. We had some privileges such as eating in the mess room.
So she was a clinical, what they would call clinical faculty, is that?
She may have had a position on the clinical faculty, but she did some research work there at the Children's Hospital.
So what were her feelings about coming to Buffalo?
Well, I think she also wanted to leave Europe, and I don't think she objected to going to the United States.
Did she have a position promised her in Buffalo before she came?
No, at that time you could not be promised any position. That was forbidden by law. You could not hire somebody with the promise of giving him a position in the United States.
There had to have been a great culture shock for you when you arrived in Buffalo and began your life there. I mean, matters like, perhaps that would be superficial, but like there was prohibition in the United States by that time. The Volstead Act had been passed. They were very suspicious of foreigners at that particular time.
But, there was a certain amount of hostility, yes. Understandably, if you came from the other side. But Gaylord had said, told me later, that he could not have hired a German, but he thought the Austrians were more acceptable.
How did you live in Buffalo? I mean, were you able to set up a comfortable life for yourselves?
Oh yes, and we made friends outside the medical school and so forth. And we heard some music and adapted. There were many things we liked.
Did you live in an apartment or rented?
We rented an apartment.
You mentioned in your article that your Buffalo laboratory was relatively primitive by modern standards. You mentioned that they had a colorimeter.
One didn't have that much instrumentation in those days.
How did it compare with European laboratories, though? The ones that you had left?
Oh, quite favorably. That was the time when one worked with pipettes and test tubes and early Meyer flasks and such things. One didn't have much instrumentation, didn't exist in biochemistry. Even when I started work in St. Louis, there wasn't very much equipment.
The chief objective of the State Institute was cancer research, was it not?
Yes.
And you quote Dr. Gaylord as saying, "Gentlemen, it behooves us to find the cause or cure of cancer, and it's got to be intravenous."
That was not Gaylord. That was not Gaylord who said that. This was his successor.
I see.
Dr. Simpson. And naturally, this is a sort of statement that you remember.
was it in any way typical of attitudes at that time, or was that already an anomaly?
It was a slight anomaly to put it that way.
Yeah. You mentioned though that they did allow you freedom to do your own your own research. In connection with your study of mammary tumors at Buffalo, you had contact with Dr. Leo Loeb of Washington University.
Yes, when I went to the annual meetings of the Cancer Society, I met Dr. Leo Loeb, and we became well acquainted.
What do you recall about him? What kind of man was he? And
he was very sensitive because he had a brother,
Jacques Loeb,
who he thought had all the shadows in. But Leo Loeb on his own was a very good scientist who had done a number of important things. And he was a very shy person. But perhaps not an ideal teacher for medical students, but he continued his work.
He gave his papers to the library, or his family gave his papers to the library, and in these papers are many, many notebooks indicating his interest in politics and in philosophy. And
oh, he was a very educated man and knew literature well, and I never talked with him extensively about politics. But I wrote the short review of him for the American Philosophical Society when he died. This was assigned to me.
So
you can, if you don't have it, just a brief appreciation.
Did you indicate that you did some teaching when you were in Buffalo? Is that correct?
Yes, I was teaching at the University of Buffalo Medical School. I knew all the people there and friends with them. And I was teaching, I gave a course in endocrinology, which they assigned to me.
Were there any institutional connections between the State Institute and Buffalo University?
No institutional connection, only personal connections. I knew the pathologist in the Buffalo General Hospital very well, because he was in Prague when I studied medicine.
What was his name?
Wait a moment. Roman. R-O-M-A-N.
Now the institute is called the Roswell Park Memorial Institute.
Yes.
Has it become now part of the medical center?
No, it is still an independent institution, but it has changed completely. To such an extent that you hardly recognize it when you come back. And it is a much more important institution now than it used to be. This is an interesting thing to me, that bad beginnings can have a good ending. And this is a very outstanding example.
You were in Buffalo when the Great Economic Depression began. Medical research was not so dependent on government funds as they are now.
But this was a state-supported institution.
But
Gaylord, the director, had very good political influence in Albany. So he got money for the institution. And it was running after a hospital, an X-ray department. Had radium, a large amount of radium in solution to pump up the emanation. And I did, in addition to my research and other things, I did the clinical laboratory work, you know, on patient blood samples and urine samples, and all things was under my
You were the chief biochemist. Was that your title? Just head of biochemistry?
Yeah, I was. But I was principally hired originally to do the routine work, laboratory work for the hospital patients.
Was there any way in which the depression affected your life? When
no, I don't think so.
You were hired to come to Washington University by Philip Schaefer in 1931.
Well, no, he couldn't do it quite that. He suggested it, and then there had to be a faculty committee.
Oh, yeah. But he was the dean at the time, right?
No,
it was Marriott. Dr. Marriott.
The Marriott was the dean. And so before that time, I had been approached to come to St. Louis, but to the clinical department, to internal medicine.
I see.
And I didn't want to go back. The stipulation was that I would have to practice medicine.
I see.
And I didn't want to do that, so I didn't accept this position.
Was this Dr. Barr?
Dr. Barr offered me this position. He came to Buffalo and talked to me at some length.
Uh-huh.
But I didn't want to. He wanted me as a laboratory worker, but he also said I would have to go back to practice as medicine, and I didn't want to do that.
What do you recall about Dr. Barr as an individual?
Well, I liked him very much. We sometimes played tennis together. He lived, in fact, close to where we lived on
Glendale?
No, not in Glendale. I don't know what the particular suburb is called. Off Manchester Road.
Uh-huh. In Webster Groves?
Yes, in Webster Groves.
Uh-huh. So at any rate, the position was that you were to replace Herbert Gasser. Was that
well, right? Herbert Gasser was still there. He was the professor of pharmacology.
Uh-huh.
And so I went there as a pharmacologist, and Gasser was still there for a year.
I see. But had he already announced his retirement, and that was the intention?
He was not retiring. He accepted a position
as
his head of physiology at Cornell in New York. But his laboratories weren't ready or something, so he stayed on for a year but did not do any teaching.
Uh-huh.
I did most of the teaching when I came there.
Did you come, though, with the stipulation that you would succeed him as head of the department?
No, I was appointed then and there as the head of the department.
Mm-hmm. Now, this faculty selection, in the course of this selection, you met all of the principal faculty. You met Dr. Erlanger.
Well, I was invited there,
uh-huh.
And I was asked to give a lecture,
uh-huh.
And I was interviewed by the professors who were on the committee,
uh-huh.
And one of them was Erlanger, and another one was Dr. Terry, the anatomist.
Uh-huh. This would be a good time for me to ask you about these gentlemen. What do you recall about Erlanger?
Well, we became very good friends, and sometimes played handball together,
uh-huh.
And shared vacations in Colorado, and did some mountain climbing together.
Uh-huh.
And so I was well acquainted.
Uh-huh. You're right that Dr. Terry had reservations about your appointment when you first interviewed him.
Yeah.
And that was your experience with a marine biological laboratory that you could show him?
Well, when I came in, I had been told by Dr. Lewis that there was strong opposition.
Uh-huh.
And so I trust he didn't interact very well. I came to his office and he was sitting behind the desk. His room was different rooms than what he had. And saw a bone that I recognized,
uh-huh.
And played with it, and he asked me when I knew what I had in my hand, and I said, well, I believe that the inner ear of the brain, which I knew it. And after that, the ice was broken, and there were no more objections.
He was a medical researcher of a almost of another era, was he not?
He came from the Edinburgh School of Anatomy.
Uh-huh.
But I was familiar with that, which meant that you went into the greatest detail. But I had a professor who lectured 1 hour about a single bone.
Uh-huh.
And that was the sort of detail, skeletal details.
So in other words, this approach to anatomy was not something...
Yeah, so it was completely familiar to me, that sort of thing. But medical schools had to have time to teach new things, and whenever there was a committee meeting on teaching, they always tried to cut down anatomy.
Uh-huh.
And when I came, anatomy still had an inordinately large amount of time assigned to it for teaching.
Uh-huh.
But it was whittled down while I was there.
He had a colleague, Dr. Cowdery, who was...
Trotter.
No, I was thinking about Edmund Cowdery.
Oh, yes. No, Cowdery was professor of microscopic anatomy,
uh-huh.
and Terry was the professor of gross anatomy. That was sometimes divided in medical school, not always.
Uh-huh. Was this did this represent any sort of tradition away from the gross anatomy to
Well, sometimes they are united and sometimes they are separate.
Uh-huh.
It's now become such a large field, microscopic anatomy.
Uh-huh.
It was justifiable by separating it. When time was taken away from anatomy, it was mostly gross anatomy.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
So it went a little bit too far. Cutting down my opinion.
You mentioned Dr. Trotter. She was on the staff
of the anatomy department. Yes, and she was the right-hand man.
Uh-huh. You also met Dr. Bronfenbrenner?
Yes.
Bacteriology.
He was bacteriology.
Uh-huh.
And later that became microbiology.
Uh-huh. What do you recall about him?
Well, he was a very nice man who took teaching very seriously had gone originally from research at the Rockefeller Institute.
He also was from Europe, was he not? He
had, from Russia.
Russia, and then he'd gone to Paris.
He spoke Russian.
Uh-huh.
But they were all much older than I remember. I was rather young in 31. 1931 when I went to St. Louis. I was 35 years
35.
Old, and they were all 50s or 60s.
Uh-huh. And that, I guess, the generation gap would have been a factor. You also met the clinical heads at that time.
Yes, Dr. Barr I knew anyway,
uh-huh.
and Dr. Graham I got to know very well because his wife, Helen Graham, was in the pharmacology department.
What do you recall about Dr. Everett Graham?
Well, he was a strong influence at the university. He was a fairly powerful man. He accepted this as a matter of course.
Uh-huh.
And he had a very good sense of humor and always had lots of stories to tell.
Uh-huh.
And of course, he was pioneering many things in surgery, such as lung operations.
Mm-hmm.
Gallbladder operations, of course. So he ran a well-known surgical department,
mm-hmm.
known generally. And for example, he was elected to the National Academy of Sciences. At that time, was exceedingly rare for a clinician.
He was a strong supporter of preclinical research, though, wasn't he?
Yes, he himself had established a strong research organization in this department.
Uh-huh. Dr. Marriott would have completed the,
yes,
the people
Marriott, the pediatrician. Well, we often went walking on Sunday together,
uh-huh.
in the Ozark.
Uh-huh.
He liked to be an outdoor man.
Uh-huh.
wanted to belittle it because he made it.
Didn't he begin as a biochemist?
Yes, he worked with Dr. Schaefer. He learned from biochemistry, and all the clinical professors had some laboratory experience and supported laboratory work. And he was a very pleasant dean.
Could you describe your laboratory at as it was in the 1930s at Washington University?
I can. I took over a pharmacological laboratory, which was equipped, student laboratory was equipped for pharmacological research. We shared the student laboratory with physiology. And the equipment in the laboratory was geared to neurophysiology. They had started with the cathode ray oscillograph, which could record the action potential of nerves. And it was that sort of equipment, but for chemistry there was practically no equipment, and I had slowly to accumulate it because money was not available. You had to get some grants. I got some grants from the used the money over years to get finally a good chemical equipment.
What kind of agencies would have given grants at that period?
Oh, that was the Rockefeller Foundation.
What was Gerty Corey's reception at Washington University? Particularly, she had some hard time being accepted in Buffalo. Did she have an easier time in St. Louis?
The stipulation was when I came that she would not have a high salary position or anything like that.
Did you immediately move to Webster Groves, or did you first live in close to the medical school?
We built a house there on Barry Road. Built a house. And we moved into that after we lived in a rented house.
Was this a pleasant experience, commuting from suburbs to...
No, it wasn't much of a trip in our comes. But we liked the outdoors, we always liked the outdoors. I was a fairly good mountain climber in my days. That's why we spent the summers in Colorado. And so in the suburbs, you could get out to see the rocks.
You had colleagues who were closer to your own age, maybe even junior colleagues. You could perhaps tell me, Earl Sutherland was in pharmacology?
He studied medicine at Washington University, and I gave him a job as a student assistant. And that's how we got acquainted. And after he finished medicine and had been through the war, I gave him a position in the department.
Severo Ochoa?
No, he came as a postdoctoral fellow. Good morning. Severo Ochoa came. So did other people. I eventually had a larger department, not in staff, but in co-workers, graduate students and postdoctoral fellows.
You mentioned Helen Graham. What do you recall?
She was on the teaching staff, and she continued to work on nerve physiology.
And
took teaching very seriously, and then eventually gave a course in statistics, which is important in pharmacology. So she was one of the first to give such a course.
I read some indication that she was able, and she and Dr. Everts Graham were able to help you personally with some family matters after World War II. Was that correct?
No, they had no know. They did not.
But you were at any rate good on good terms with both of them as individuals.
Yes.
During World War II, you were effectively head of two departments. Was this not
yes,
the case?
Yes. It was then that Dr. Schaefer became dean, and he asked me to look after the teaching of biochemistry. So I was teaching pharmacology and biochemistry.
Was it particularly difficult to head up two departments?
No.
And
no, I didn't mind that. I would like to mention, though, going back for a moment, that in addition to Dr. Ochoa, there was also Arthur Cromberg.
Oh, yeah.
Came to see me as a postdoctoral fellow, and Christian de Duve.
So you had some very distinguished people who
later on
yeah,
distinguished,
yeah.
And Hermann Kalkar, and many others.
There was some talk that you would take overall responsibility for all the preclinical training.
Yes, that was Dr. Schaefer's idea and wish, and I definitely refused to do that. It so happened that when this became an active problem, I was recovering from virus pneumonia.
Uh-huh.
And I was in Florida, sent down to Florida.
The only illness I had
while I was in St. Louis. And I was recovering there, and I was called up on the telephone, and they said that if I wouldn't do that, they would appoint someone in pharmacology. And I said, go ahead, by all means, do it.
Uh-huh.
And that's all he allowed me. I didn't want to do that. Number one, I was not interested in administration. Number two, I strongly believe that there should be separate departments, otherwise we don't develop. Pharmacology needed a separation from the other. Directed the whole south building, which contained biochemistry, pharmacology, and physiology, all three. The other departments might have suffered because I would probably have emphasized biochemistry.
You in
a very good reason for not doing it.
You had a marked preference, personal preference, for biochemistry.
By that time. Yes.
Yet there were, I've heard somebody say, and this is just really talk, that you, in effect, along with Dr. Graham, in effect, ran the medical school.
I never aspired to run the medical school, and I only made myself heard if there was trouble that I thought maybe some. I was Graham from the clinical side. I never, as you can see, aspired to run the preclinical department, so I didn't want to do that. And I think it was a very wise idea of mine, because it could have taken too much time away from research.
You said that you were succeeded by Oliver Lowry. What do you recall about him when he first came to Washington University?
He complained that we had left him no equipment. We only gave him, he sometimes joked about that, but he was also a biochemist and not a pharmacologist.
Huh?
Because the old pharmacology held all this against me. Ochoa, when he left, became professor of pharmacology. Another biochemist moved into pharmacology, Ori Lowry, and then there was Arnold Lentz, who was also a more chemical influence. And so that was the general thing held against me by the old pharmacologist that I was introducing biochemistry.
In the Department of Biochemistry, there was a member by the name of Ethel Ronzoni.
Yes.
and told you had some difficulties in getting along with her. Is that the case? Is that true?
No, not really different. But I didn't keep her on when I was in head of the department.
Wasn't that you couldn't stand working with her? Well,
we have, I think, through other people, we had one or two papers in common. She didn't do very much at that time. I wanted to have young people who were doing good times to see who were active.
As you can tell by now, I'm sort of skirting all the work that, any mention of the work that led to your Nobel Prize. Was there any speculation before your winning the Nobel Prize that you might be a candidate?
No, I have no idea. We don't generally hear from Sweden, they don't meet, as far as I know. You don't hear anything before them.
How was the news broken to you that you were?
Well, a journalist appeared the night before and interviewed me and told us that I'm not sure why he was interviewing me. So that's how it happened.
And then the next day you got official confirmation of the?
Yes, while I was lecturing.
How did this award affect your research career? Did it make it easier for you? Did it make it harder for you?
Well, it certainly had the effect of working harder because you want to prove to your colleagues that this was not a treat, but that you deserve it, so you want to do more. Because the laboratory was our laboratory, so it was known before, but after that we had more applications for construction, so more people wanted to come in. Things were easier to be sure.
How about more support for your research activities? Did this open up doors for grants?
Probably.
You received offers from other medical schools,
yes,
beginning this,
yes,
time,
I know.
Including Harvard.
Including Harvard.
Why didn't you go? Why didn't you?
Well, because I was happy enough in St. Louis. I had what I wanted for my work, and it would have been a lot of time. And I could have gone to Cleveland to. I went to the Rockefeller Institute. I had a very strong offer at the Rockefeller Institute when Herbert Gasser was the director. After he left from there, he became the director. So he offered him a big job. But the Rockefeller then was not a university, you know, it was really separated from the young people I liked. That young people around, people at all stages of development.
Gertie Curry, of course, was your co-recipient of the Nobel Prize. How did this affect her life?
Well, of course, put her more into the limelight as a woman, actually, since at that time very few women were chosen, so. But I don't think it affected our lives as much as you think.
Did she have her own laboratory by this time?
Our laboratory facilities were always very small, and we never had a very big staff. And I think it worked on a small scale by present standards, on a very small scale.
But her own verification.
She always worked with her own hands.
She was across the corridor from you, is that correct? At her, where she worked, or did you work in the same physically in the same room?
We sometimes worked physically in the same room.
How was the teamwork? Did you make each make independent verifications of
Well, in the first place, she could do more laboratory work than I. She was not diverted by teaching. She was invited to give lectures and things like that. She was not diverted by teaching and by administration and by committee meetings and so forth. She did none of that, so she spent her whole day in the laboratory. And so she did many experiments that I could not do.
Would she have liked to have taught, or was she happy not to be into?
She was not interested in teaching medical students. So she had, on occasion, her own graduate students. So her teaching was more on the graduate level.
There was a third recipient of the prize that year, Bernardo Houssay. What communication, if any, did you have with him prior to the?
Well, he sent us his reprints, he sent him our reprints, and I had met him several times. And he was a very well-educated man who did some pioneer work in endocrinology.
Was all his work in Argentina, or did he begin?
He worked mainly in Argentina.
Was the research climate, international research climate, different after, immediately after World War II, and did this situation, or had this been just a gradual movement
the
out
the
of
the prominent people in research anywhere always had contact.
So it was not suddenly more an international
Of course, Argentina was not a particularly favorable place to do research.
This was the Perón years, perhaps, in Argentina?
Well, Louis Levy was also worked with me there.
He was Argentine?
Yes, and he is the only really prominent researcher now in Argentina. But he is in a private institution.
About this time you began, I believe, pushing for additional research space at Washington University.
Well, that was because, pharmacology was originally shoved in between biochemistry below and physiology up above, so it had only half a floor. And that included the lecture. If you go to the South Cleveland, you will see that half the floor was not very much space. And so when the negotiations were on with the Rockefeller Institute, when they finally pressed me to make the decision, I said, I'll stay here if you increase the laboratory space for the preclinical department.
Now this, when another building was built, it was called the Cancer Research Building, was it not?
No, the building that was then built, because they said yes, they would, was the connecting link between the North Cleveland and South Cleveland.
Yeah.
It made it an H. North Cleveland, South Cleveland, and in between that corridor. Here's the library, here's the corridor, here's the South.
But that's called officially the Cancer Research Building.
Yes.
Is that because they had to officially designate it for cancer research? Was that part of the stipulation for getting the money?
I think so, but into that building moved biochemistry and physiology and also pharmacology. Ollie Lowry had very little space. He was more expensive than I, and he, since these were very tall floors, you know, the building was built in 1914, he made partitions to do that. He could have separate rooms below and above, and so he took more space and then also moved into the new building. Well, cancer research was in that building also, or still is.
You worked a great deal with, or administratively with Dr. Barry Wood in internal medicine. Yes, he made a connection.
He was the successor of David Bowie. Yes.
Uh-huh. What do you recall about him?
As you know, he left internal medicine and went to Hopkins, where he became the professor of microbiology.
Yes.
And I think was more of a research man than a physician.
Uh-huh.
But he ran a good department and a very well liked, was a good administrator, but his heart was not in clinical medicine.
The dean by the early 50s was Robert Moore.
Yes.
Was it not? Now, how did you get along with him?
Oh, I never had bad relationship with anybody.
Was he an effective dean in your?
Yeah, he was a good dean.
In looking a little bit beyond that into the early 60s, you were a member of the executive faculty, of course, and you were party to negotiations with the trustees of Barnes Hospital for a renewal of the contracts with between the medical school and the hospital. And this particularly involved dealing with Barnes chairman Edgar Queenie. And this was a very particularly trying episode for both institutions.
Yes, yes.
Could you tell me something about that?
I think Queenie was a strange man who thought that the people who took a full-time position at Boston University didn't live on a fixed salary, that there was something wrong with people who didn't get money. They were full-time people, they were full-time.
Uh-huh.
And if they made money through private practice, they went back to the medical school.
Uh-huh.
And a surgeon, particularly, if he worked outside, would make 4, 5, 6 times the salary that Boston was paid. And he didn't think that the people who accepted this were quite right in their head.
He never pressed for a separation of...
He built this building that is next to Barnes Hospital, and he had hoped that thereby he would break down the rule whereby the part-time people were appointed by Washington University. He thought that more part-time citizens should move in and should be allowed to practice in the hospital, rather than be selected by Martin Luther. We hoped through that building where there were offices,
yes,
would sort of have him sneak in.
What became called Queenie Tower after.
It didn't work out.
I can guess why the medical school was so much against him, but could you formulate what was their position? Dr. Dempsey was the head of the medical school by then.
He suffered a great deal during that time.
It became almost a personal confrontation between these two men, Dempsey and Queenie, did it not?
Well, there was a very disagreeable time. The faculty was a bit divided too. They all expected to get a lot of money from Queenie because he had no heirs, and so they expected a lot of money would come to Washington University through him, but they didn't.
So this is a factor I've never heard of. It was waiting for the golden goose to lay the golden egg. Who would have supported a change more on the lines that Queenie sought within the medical school?
No, I wouldn't. Past history was a very solid point. So that was the main trouble, that the faculty was divided.
Gertie Corey died in 1957. She had a long bout with anemia, is that correct?
10 years.
And this gradually affected her capacity as a researcher and as
She worked more or less until the news.
Then you were a single man for 3 years, and in 1960 you married Ann Fitzgerald Jones. Can you tell me about her? She was not connected with medicine at all.
No, she was not.
And she was she in any related to the Jones family that were benefactors of Children's Hospital?
Yes. First husband, son, a grandson of
Robert McKittrick Jones.
Yes.
You retired in 1966, but before you did, what was your, as you, in the 1960s, what was your work at Washington University like?
Well, I continued working with postdoctoral fellows, and I did a fair amount of work in those days. I'm still doing it.
As you approached retirement, did it cause of personal anxiety for you that you would have to release control over?
No, not. I decided then and there that I wouldn't stay on. Then you had the time and feeling to stay in the same place and lose your facilities mostly. You don't have anybody to work with, you don't have any equipment, and you are only in the way of your successor if you stay on.
Yet many do. Dr. Lowry, for example, has stayed on after he was succeeded by Dr. Needleman.
Well, that depends on the circumstances, but they were not trivial, but then in any case, I decided right away that I would move out. I worked to the last moment, paid no attention to retirement, then decided to move out, and I had several offers.
Did you have any voice in the selection of your successor?
No, none whatsoever.
Did you get Dr. Vagelis, is this his name?
Vagelis.
Did you get along with him in those
days? I didn't know him. And we did not overlap. By the time he came, I had left.
For a time, you were in the anatomy department. Is that possible? Is my information correct that you physically had your laboratory?
Oh, they found room for me in the anatomy department, an office where my library been, and an addition laboratory. And eventually they promised me I could have one collaborator in something like that. But I had no equipment, of course.
And it was that precisely that lack of equipment and a situation that whereby you could have continued that. Did you resent that at all?
No, I think that you have to make room for younger people. You have to retire. If you have no retirement, things don't work out. So I thought that it's in the natural course of events. The only difference is that I didn't stay in St. Louis, but moved on.
Where did you go immediately after leaving St. Louis?
I came to the Massachusetts General Hospital.
And you were in the enzyme research laboratory?
Well, they gave me that title.
Well, that's been over 10 years that you were there then.
Yes. In fact, Washington University said I could stay there maybe 3 years. Then it would be very difficult. I felt that I was probably good for longer than 3 years.
So you were officially on leave for 3 years from Washington University, is it?
No, I don't think so.
For a time, the catalogs.
I'm still listed as professor emeritus or something. I don't know. there was a little move that I would come back.
Where would you have gone had you come back? Where would you have set your laboratory up?
Well, they didn't make any specifications, of course. Simply that the present chancellor, who has been the vice president for medical affairs.
Uh-huh. Well, had been a student of yours, Dr. Danforth.
Oh, yes. Yeah. Dr. Danforth worked with me for 7 years.
Uh-huh.
And after he became chancellor, he once very quietly asked him or something.
Uh-huh.
He had happened to be here in some occasions. He came for a short meeting, but it was never done more extensively.
What was it like to work at Massachusetts Dental Hospital?
Well, it was very pleasant. What I wanted in the way of facilities. I had grants and could buy the equipment I needed.
Uh-huh.
When I moved most of the equipment here, I was in a building called, not right away, but eventually in a building called Temporary 2. It was temporary since World War II,
uh-huh.
And eventually it had to come down.
Uh-huh.
And so I had to move out before the building was coming down.
They had no problems at no idea at MGH like at Barnes Hospital, no question but that should be a research hospital. I mean, they fully accepted research departments within the hospital.
Yes. Oh, yes. They had a research building. I was years ago on the advisory committee of the scientific advisory committee of the MGH.
Uh-huh.
And it was during that time that I helped them to persuade the trustees to build a research building.
Uh-huh. Oh, so in many respects they owed you a great debt that they were...
Oh, I don't know. I was one of several trustees.
Uh-huh.
So, I'm an amphibian, I was on both sides of the fence.
Uh-huh.
So I served for 7 years and also partly supported Fritz Lippmann, who is the friend of mine. There was a turnover among the trustees, anyway, among the scientific advisors.
I'm trying to think of who. Fritz Lippmann was the mentor of somebody at Washington University now. Somebody.
He was a chiropractor.
Dr. Nathans, perhaps. Dr. No? I'm just thinking for a moment of Daniel Nathans. Of John Hopkins.
There may be students.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What is life in Boston?
Very pleasant. We had many friends before we came.
You alluded to the fact that you had done research at Woods Hole for many years. Is this some of the basis?
No, I never worked at Woods Hole. I spent one summer there when I was supposed to write a review.
Uh-huh.
I never got to writing a single line.
Uh-huh.
And after that, I thought that Woods Hole, where you meet all kinds of things like that, and you can't go out on the street without meeting somebody.
Yeah.
And you have to go to cocktail parties and whatnot. I couldn't do any work there. So I decided that's not the place. So I've never worked in this room.
Could you compare Boston to St. Louis? You go frequently back to Europe, I understand.
Yes, but I only go to Europe if there's some meeting or something. I never travel per se. There has to be some occasion.
Uh-huh. you never go for sentimental or family reasons or anything like that?
Well, I have very little family left in Europe, and I like to visit northern Italy. We have some friends there. Italy and so on, but there's generally a meeting connected. Mm-hmm. Last summer we were twice in Europe. First we were at a meeting in Scotland, which is a very nice meeting, and then you stretch things a little bit, you stay a little longer after the meeting. Second time I had a meeting in Geneva, Switzerland.
Well, Dr. Corey, is there anything that I haven't covered in, there's many things I haven't covered, but are there, along the line of conversation that we've had, is there anything that has been left unsaid?
Well, I suppose there are many things that you left unsaid, but you've covered a certain part of my life.
Well, I want to thank you very much. I hope this...
What you're going to do is just transcribe it?
We don't have the money to transcribe. What we do is put it on a very high quality tape and make a copy of it, and then I index the remarks that are made, and then the indexing is done and put on a computer, and we can compare remarks on subjects of things that other people have made.
See, you scrutinize concordance or not.
Yeah. Well, once again, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Very nice.